Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the results of this year's presidential election did not result in the breaking of the nation's highest glass ceiling, today we hear from a historian who has recounted the story of a woman who broke more political glass ceilings than most any other woman, all while never holding elective office. Eleanor Roosevelt forever changed the images and duties of a first lady during her 13 years, as also as a proponent of racial and social justice, in diplomacy, in human rights, and as a worldwide humanitarian. Historian Blanche Wieson Cook has spent over 25 years writing about ER, as she calls her, and the third and final volume of her noted and acclaimed biography of this towering figure of the 20th century has just been published. Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, is published by Viking, and it focuses primarily on the war years and immediately after, when the president's attention was captured solely by the war efforts, and how Eleanor became the main champion for domestic and social efforts. Of course, after FDR's death, Eleanor becomes a primary spokesperson for a lasting world peace and human rights for all. Blanche Wieson Cook is a distinguished professor of history at the John Jay College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. She's a senior editor of the Garland Library of War and Peace, and author of two previous volumes on Eleanor Roosevelt, as well as The Declassified Eisenhower, and is a former vice president for research at the American Historical Association. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Blanche Wieson Cook, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
As you pick up the third volume of your story of Eleanor Roosevelt, as you pick up ER's story, as you referred to her throughout the book, she's advocating for an anti-lynching law, trying to place European Jewish refugees here in the United States, both with considerable resistance and what might be surprising to some, very sparse support from FDR. How did Eleanor react to that lack of support for what now seems to be, you know, as we are currently embroiled in a refugee situation today, this considerable resistance?
Well, she really never stopped fighting for what she believed in. And one of the amazing things about their marriage is they trusted each other. She always believed that basically FDR and she agreed about what was right and what needed to happen. And she admired his political ability to juggle a very, what was called Dixiecrat-dominated Congress in order to get his priorities passed. He could not and did not push to integrate the military during the war, for example. He did not say a word in support of the anti-lynching bill, which never passed in the United States. And so on issues of race and rescue, which are the themes of Volume 3 and the themes, alas, of this moment, Eleanor Roosevelt was an agitator. And she really always said, and this is her message for today, she always said, we know what is right, we know what is just, we know what we have to do, and we have to build movements to do what has to be achieved. And she began to be an organizer for movements. She said, she called it trooping for democracy in the 1920s. We have to go door to door, block by block, community by community, to make the changes that have to be made. And she always believed, from the 1920s on, that there would be peace if there were justice, there would be communities of democracy if there were jobs for everybody, education for everybody, health for everybody.
You mentioned that they did see eye to eye. Was there a public-private divide in what Franklin Delano Roosevelt? I mean, was there ever any tensions over what seemed to be her moves that were far beyond what the political possibilities were of that time, at least as the way Franklin Delano Roosevelt saw them?
Right. Well, he said to her, you know, he never silenced her on issues of great urgency. And she had her newspaper column from 1936 on. She had a radio show. She's the first lady of radio. She wrote countless articles. And except for some issues, he didn't silence her. But his decisions were very, as I deal with in the book, some of them are very strange. Like, the man who is most responsible for the United States' failure to rescue people and really create haven for refugees. And here we are, you know, facing a world of 65 million refugees. What has to happen? What kind of haven has to happen? And Eleanor Roosevelt agitated with her allies for a haven when the great well-known ship, the SS St. Louis, was sent back with over 300 passengers the same weekend. This headline news, the same weekend the King and Queen of England are in the United States to get the United States out of its isolationist moment, to get the United States sympathetic to England so that the U.S. and England can achieve an alliance. That's his priority. And the boat, the SS St. Louis, is not his priority. It's not mentioned. It goes back to Europe, and Eleanor Roosevelt says, never again will that happen if she can help it. And the next ship is called the SS Kwanzaa, Q-U-A-N-Z-A. It's an incredible story. And it lands in Virginia. It's going to be sent back with 80 refugees aboard. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, no, let them stay. They are my guests. And a man named Breckinridge Long in the State Department is in charge of all issues having to do with refugees, and he goes berserk, and he protests. He is the only one to make these decisions. These refugees might be communists. They might be anti-American. He doesn't want them in. He makes the decisions. And to the great tragedy of war as it unfolds, he is in power. FDR never fires him, and he takes over from that moment on. So the Kwanzaa is the last boat until 1944, when finally there is change, and there's an emergency refugee committee that Henry Morgenthau organizes.
Yeah, and you sort of detail that story in the book about how Henry Morgenthau basically bypasses the State Department, because the State Department, the feeling is they're not sympathetic to refugees at all, and certainly not sympathetic to the Jews.
Right. And it's really, that moment is a very telling moment. Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, really raises the question, why didn't FDR fire Breckinridge Long? He could have, and he didn't. So that's the tension in the book. And we know, because people were witness to this event, Eleanor Roosevelt says to FDR, but Franklin, you know, he's a fascist. And FDR says, well, he may be a fascist, but don't use that word. And that's the end of it. And he never fires.
Wow. It was that simple.
That simple.
Now, you know, you mentioned the St. Louis at the time of the royalty visiting Hyde Park. And of course, this was a big moment. And it was a very important family moment where you still have the emphasis of Sarah Delano and Franklin's mother, and again, the conflicted relationship the three of them had when the St. Louis comes over. And you said one of the things that you could not see any mention of the St. Louis in the papers.
Well, it was in the papers. But
not in her personal papers.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no mention of the St. Louis in Eleanor Roosevelt's papers.
Do you think that was just because she was preoccupied with the royal visit, or do you think it was not on her radar at the time?
No, I think that it's one of those moments where silence, for diplomatic reasons, was imposed on her, and she accepted it.
Hmm. But obviously it made an impression on her because...
Because of the Kwanzaa.
Yeah.
We know that she agitated against it.
During those 2 years, we think of the Roosevelt years as being sort of a democratic phase, ushering in a long democratic phase that, you know, seems to go right on through the 1960s. But really, in the late 1930s, there was incredible pushback against the New Deal. And in fact, I think even though there were still democratic majorities in Congress, Roosevelts were feeling very constrained about their program and the ideals that they wanted to get through. in the late 1930s. Would that
yes,
be a fair assessment?
There is pushback. There's a tremendous right-wing movement building. The isolationists dominate, and issues of race are to the fore. And, you know, I've been talking about J. Edgar Comey, who had very inappropriately interfered with Hillary Clinton's election campaign. And the predecessor for that is John Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover hated Eleanor Roosevelt, and from 1923 on began to compile this extraordinary FBI file. He followed her. Her phones were tapped. Her hotel rooms were bugged. And again, you have to wonder, you know, why didn't FDR get rid of J. Edgar Hoover? The bottom line was everything she said about race, about integration, about lynching, about racial violence, every word, every effort to heal racial tension is in her FBI file. It represents over 80% of her file.
I would suppose for a historian that's a great record.
It is a great record, and we got it through the Freedom of Information Act, and it's filled with his marginal comments. He hated her. He calls her that old hen. The old cow is meeting with her communist friends again. And we need to pause to remember that in the anti-communist crusade and the Red Scare, which really dominates the 1940s and 50s, every civil rights hero, every civil rights leader is called a communist.
Right. If you're for integration in the South,
if
you're a communist.
If you were for integration in the South, you had to be a Red.
Yeah.
And that's part of this, you know, the Democratic history is burdened by what, you know, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois said, you know, the history of the 20th century is the history of the color line. And, you know, obviously the history of the 21st century is the refusal to acknowledge the continuance of the color line.
Now, my guest today is Blanche Wieson-Cook, the Distinguished Professor of History at John Jay College, who has just completed her 3-volume history of Eleanor Roosevelt. This is going to go down as an important biographical set. Eleanor Roosevelt, Volume 3, The War Years and Beyond, 1939 to 1962, has just been published, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. And really, we should mention that the book really does focus on probably about the first 9 years of that period, I would think, the 1939 to 1948, and certainly especially on the war years. As the war comes on, where is Eleanor Roosevelt? Is she out in the forefront on talking about the dangers of fascism? Is she confronting isolationism, or where exactly?
Well, she starts out as a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, saying, you know, when war begins, you cannot think about the needs of peace. And so she hopes that war won't happen. But as Nazism really starts to mobilize and the tragedy of Hitler's domination of Europe becomes clear, she changes her mind and is supportive of the draft and is supportive of, you know, the U.S. getting into the war and opposes isolation. Freedom, you know, the future of freedom depends on U.S. involvement and U.S. support for the Allies. And then she wants, you know, she wants to do war work. And she encourages women to join the military. She encourages, she champions the Tuskegee Airmen. You know, she goes around the country and around the world visiting people in want and need and trouble all the time, and visits wounded service men in hospitals in the Pacific, in Latin America, and she's in England during the Blitz. These are really highlights of her life. And her theme throughout is justice, civil rights, the end of segregation. We must see each other with dignity and equality, and then we will have justice and peace. And that's really like her theme. And then when FDR dies and Truman sends her off to the United Nations, she becomes very important in the effort to get the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. passed, and it does pass on 10 December 1948. And you know, the words of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights are really the fulfillment of her lifelong quest for everybody having education, training, dignity, justice, jobs, housing. My favorite chapter in Volume 2 is the chapter on Arthurdale, where Eleanor Roosevelt creates this model housing for the poorest coal miners,
right,
you know, in America. And that's her vision. You know, we're not going to have justice until there's decent housing for everybody, decent, excellent education. She calls, long before Bernie Sanders called for free public education up through K through college, in 1943, Eleanor Roosevelt said, we have to have public, free college education for everybody. Isn't that wonderful? And my favorite quote for this moment is, I can give you 100% literacy and full employment. How? One teacher, 5 students.
Wow, a 5-to-1 teacher-student ratio.
Yeah, and then everybody would learn to read and write and be creative. And here we are for the first time in a country that always supported public education, now for the first time closing public schools all over the country and ending sports and music programs. Eleanor Roosevelt would have been aghast. Sports and music, she always said, music was the universal language. Everybody needed to study music, to play an instrument, to sing in a choir, and sports was her lifeline.
Hmm. Now, you know, through the 1930s, we think of Eleanor Roosevelt as being FDR's eyes and ears as the New Deal's coming approach. You mentioned her championing Arthur Dale. She was visiting CCC camps. She was visiting WPA projects all around the country. Now, when the war comes on, does she take that same role for the war effort for FDR? Is she still the eyes and ears? Or is FDR too involved in the grand strategy, really? It seems like there's a growing divide between the two.
Well, he isn't well, and he gets very impatient with all of the things that she asks him to do. And there is more and more tension. But there is also the continuation of his dependence on her. As, you know, their mutual friends always said, she was not just his eyes and his ears, she was his conscience. So she, you know, she talks about the GI Bill of Rights when she comes back from Australia, where there is already a GI Bill of Rights, and then FDR introduces the GI Bill of Rights.
Wow.
She goes to visit Japanese internment camps, the Gila camp in Arizona, and she comes back and says, you know, these young people have to go to college. She gets the Japanese out of the internment camps, the young people into college, and they need to join the military. If they want to join the military, they do, and you have, you know, the highest rank, you know, awarded servicemen in the Japanese units. He agrees to those, you know, most important things.
And the very idea that she is visiting, going across the seas during wartime, literally being a very public persona in visiting hospitals throughout the South Pacific. There's very few images of presidential families during wartime spending as much time as Eleanor Roosevelt did, either entertaining wounded troops, spending time with them on the bases as sort of a symbol of home.
Right. Well, she had 4 sons in the military, and all of the sons in the military were her sons, you know, and her empathy, her ability to identify with people in want, in need, in trouble, is really the key to her entire life, which intensifies during the war years. People always ask me, how did she get that way? And her identification with people in want, in need, in trouble, was her own family. Her father, who she loved, was an alcoholic who died at the age of 34. How much do you have to drink? And we know about alcoholism, the family disease, to die at the age of 34. And so Eleanor Roosevelt's commitment to find out what people wanted and needed and to make it better for people in want and need and trouble, just like her own family, begins, you know, at a very young age.
My guest today is Blanche Wieson-Cook, whose latest volume, the final volume of her three-volume History of Eleanor Roosevelt, is titled Eleanor Roosevelt, the Volume 3, The War Years and Beyond. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Will you detail her incredible schedule? I mean, you write about her Griselda moods, as she referred to them when she would get depressed. And really, it sounds like it's almost overexertion, because she had this incredible schedule. Could you detail sort of what a typical day in Eleanor Roosevelt's life was? Because it's exhausting.
It is exhausting. Well, she woke up. She had very little sleep, maybe 4 to 6 hours every night. She woke up and did exercises to the radio. She did, you know, exercises to the radio, and then she very often, before breakfast, rode her horse if she was in the country. She swam. Exercise was very important to her, just as sports and schools was very important to her. And then she went to meetings and did all the things she did. She traveled all over. She wrote dozens and dozens of articles a month and a daily column. And she did all the things one does as First Lady. I mean, she was the hostess, and she was on radio and then subsequently on television. But it's really her travels and her meeting people and her interviewing people and her community building. And she, you know, she had a team of friends and allies and besties who gave her strength and courage. And, of course, she got depressed. I mean, how could you not be depressed during, you know, World War II, when the news is coming in from around the world about the massacres and the concentration camps? I mean, you know, they had all this information. So she would get depressed when things didn't happen fast enough, and then she would get out of it. And how she got out of it was to do more and more work. The more work she did, the less depressed she got.
What was really surprising about the biography is with how little regard other men in authority treated her, even though she's the First Lady. And really, I suppose it's because she's breaking the mold of the First Lady. I mean, shattering the mold of the First Lady. You know, even when she's named to the UN delegation, she's not taken seriously. She would speak up in meetings. There would be sort of an acknowledgement of her having spoken, and then the conversation would resume as if she had never spoken in the first place.
And that's why women had to be strident. She would bang her fist on the table and be strident and say, "What I said was very important. You must listen." Because she knew. She spoke so many languages. She knew what was going on. And finally, John Foster Dulles apologized to her and said he was pleased that they worked together. But Eleanor Roosevelt made an observation that's a very important observation. Men hate women with power. And that, you know, message to all women running for public office. It's not over. Men hate women with power. And I have to say, in my own life, after my Eisenhower book, I served on the State Department Historical Advisory Committee. And to keep the Freedom of Information Act alive, to keep what we got declassified when President Reagan was trying to reclassify it. And it was I was the first woman on this committee, and it was really astonishing. And I understood why, you know, women get the reputation for being strident, you know.
Uh-huh.
Men just tend not to listen. They do, and I had a great team. And we still have to fight for freedom of information and the declassification of documents so that we can be uplifted by our history.
You write in the book that actually when she's assigned to the UN delegation, I believe it was Senator Vandenberg who came up to him and said, "Oh, you're going to be on the human rights." And it was almost like she was being shunted aside.
Yeah, well, they thought of it as a little social group.
Yeah. And in fact, that becomes probably the crowning achievement of the early UN is the Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
Absolutely.
And that was her area.
Yeah. And then Truman at first told her not to support the Economic and Social Rights Covenant, which, I mean, the Declaration got divided into two parts so it would be passed, and it was passed. And then Truman says, don't support the economic and social rights part of it. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, no, you can't talk human rights to people who are hungry. If you want me to oppose this because it's a Soviet-initiated thing, everybody has the right to work, everybody has the right to education, everybody has the right to jobs, to housing, and so on. If you want me to vote against it, I will resign. And Truman says, no, don't resign. Follow your heart. And that's how the whole, you know, the Universal Declaration contains everything. But the U.S., when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, George Herbert Walker Bush got the civil and political rights ratified. But we have never had a conversation about the Economic and Social Rights Covenant. Hmm. And there's an organization now called NESRI, NESRI.org, that is beginning to agitate, that has been agitating, to get the U.S. to ratify the Economic and Social Rights Covenant. But, of course, given this disastrous moment, that's far-fetched.
Last question. You've spent so many years with Eleanor Roosevelt writing this three-volume history. What is your strongest takeaway about Eleanor Roosevelt, how she should speak to us today?
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt never stopped growing and changing. And she never stopped arguing that what we need to do is to build movements to oppose the greedy and the banksters, the people who would take away our power. If democracy is to survive, we have to have a liberal democracy that cares about all the people. And that's her theme. And we need movements, and we need to go what she called trooping for democracy. And the big, you know, big message is we are all united. She was very moved by Wendell Willkie's 1942 book, One World. Everything that happens anywhere affects everybody, everywhere. We are one world. And that is her message as she goes into the UN. The UN can save us from perpetual war. You know, and it's really FDR said in 1940, we will have a liberal democracy or we will return to the dark ages. And I dedicate Volume 3 based on Eleanor Roosevelt's vision. This book is dedicated to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls.
Historian Blanche Wieson Cook is the author of the three-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. The final volume has just been published, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.